My dog has fleas. My dog has. So, oh, sorry, everybody. I'm just waiting for Sam Neill to arrive, and I think he should be. Hang on, this might be him now. Just a sec. I'll put the ukulele down. Right, just a sec. Oh, g'day, Sam. How are you? Oh, mate, it's wonderful that you come to join us here at the weekend of this Saturday night.
On this beautiful day, and what a spot you've got here.
It is. Dunleavin is, I think, it's God's country, as they say.
When I turn around, I can see all the way to Perth, or is that, what was that, Brisbane? What is it?
Well, it fluctuates a bit. It depends on the, we have a thing called the Dunleavin Doctor, which is a kind of wind that comes through and sort of blows stuff over, and it's difficult. Sometimes, you can see all sorts of things.
That's beautiful. And what a lovely little house this is. Well, it's not really a house, is it? So what we call a batch in New Zealand.
I've heard that, a batch in, why? A batch. We call it we just call it a holiday house, but some people call them shacks or whatever. But in New Zealand, a batch.
In the deep south, a crib. The origin of those two words is obscure, but crib sounds nice. It sounds like a place of shelter, isn't it? You
know, it does, it really does.
Away from the wind. I bet it's a bit of a wild spot here in the winter, isn't it?
Oh, it can be, yes. Look, we'll come in, we'll talk about this. I don't want to leave you here on the veranda. Come through, and we'll go out to the kitchen, and look, this is our little dog, Billy, here. Say hello to Sam, Billy.
Oh, what sort of dog is this?
He's a kind of, he's half bitzer and half mongrel.
He's
so.
Strange looking dog, but friendly. No.
We normally keep a jug of cold water on hand for when he does that. Get off! Off! Out!
Go to your basket.
That's right, he's gone now. Sam, come through. Look, I'll just give you a bit of a rundown of the house here. As I always show everybody, I'm very proud of this. This is the second bedroom. And Jeffrey Smart, Australia's greatest living painter, he was here some months ago, and he decided that he would repaint the second bedroom, and he did a lovely burnt orange. Do you like
it? It's a beautiful. Did he sleep in these bunks here?
No, he didn't, which is a bit of a pity, because he might have got a better feel, because the orange doesn't match the kind of the turquoise chenille bedspread.
He couldn't sleep with that colour? Or what?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, he's a fair age now, Jeffrey Smart.
Is he getting on now?
He is a bit, but look, the way he whips that roller around the room, it's like no tomorrow.
And his paintings are as young as ever.
They are. Yeah. Very, very fascinating man. But look, come through to the kitchen, and look, come in here. Grab a chair around the Laminex table. And,
thank you very
and
much.
Look, I know that you're a vigneron nowadays, as well as being one of the world's most famous actors. I mean, you are now spending a lot of time.
I brought a bottle of wine with me. Shall we drink it later on?
Well, I
on
might.
On the veranda or anything?
Well, actually, I was hoping that I could actually keep the bottle of wine, and I'll give you some of ours instead. Here, I've actually been experimenting. A bloke up the road, Ross, he has a vineyard. It's called the Grapes of Ross, and he gave me some cuttings. And if you wouldn't mind coming out into the yard, and we'll have a bit of a look later at my cuttings and see what you think. But we've got these ones. These come from the local agricultural show. This is a bottle of run-of-the-mill Chardonnay. It's made from privet, and I've actually grown this one. It's named after my sister Narelle. It's called Smashed Crab. It's a smashed crab claret, and it's after sort of the way she looks a bit. But look, have a drop of this. Hang on. That's the run of the mill privet Chardonnay. What is it?
What my grandfather used to call a brimmer. You can hardly pick it up without spilling it over your trousers.
Okay.
Mm. Oh, that's really foul.
Is it? Oh, I thought it was
more, please.
More, maybe we need to kind of distill the privet a bit longer. But before we start talking about your brilliant career, obviously that's a line that has been thrown up several times. I'm sure that you've never heard that before. But what got you into a lifestyle of growing grapes and making wine?
I had a little rush of blood to the head, which I know I don't regret, because it's been a lot of fun. But it's been a bit of a roller coaster. We've had frosts, we've had winds, we've had everything that God can throw at you. We've had a bit of it. But we've come through, and we're on our 10th vintage this year. And I started with very modest ambitions. Now I'm extremely ambitious, and I've become sort of mildly obsessive about it. So I like to think that every year the wine gets better, and it's certainly improving in the bottle, and I take it around the world with some pride, actually.
Yes. In Australia, there's been so much wine, so much Australian wine, and New Zealand wines have really made an impact into the Australian market, which is amazing, really, in recent years. I mean, it's most.
Well, we make different wine, I mean, we concentrate on things like Sauvignon Blanc. There's not very much of that grown here, I don't think.
Right.
And Pinot Noir, which is what I grow. And there's only two or three little tiny pockets in Tasmania and Victoria that you can actually grow Pinot Noir in Australia. Australia's great for Shiraz and those sort of things, and we're no good at that stuff. Right. We're not really.
And I'm told that a wine connoisseur told me the other day, as I was down outside the pub in Dunlivin, that your wines are right up there as some of the finest wines you can buy in New Zealand.
Could you get it at the Dunlivin pub?
We could order it in. It would take a bit of a while, but we have a kind of closed tariff kind of arrangement here where most of the wine that we have here is grown here and we don't allow stuff in. But, well, we have under the floor a 44-gallon drum of Auntie Topsy's Punch, which is made in Cowra. But every week someone has some. It's fabulous stuff. We might get onto that a bit later.
Can you get weeds with it as well?
Absolutely. But before we go any further, I'd just like to ask you, I've got the stereogram here. Is there a song that you'd like to listen to before we move into the next part of our...
Well, since it's a nice evening and we're feeling optimistic and... the sun's about to get it. Well, look, how about my friend Tim Finn? His last single, Couldn't Be Done.
Fantastic, Sam. Let's listen to that.
We had no idea that it couldn't be done. And we needed to find a like-minded someone. We had no idea that it couldn't be done. No idea. Send the darkness back to Europe. Waking up in the warm Pacific sun.
We're at the Weekender with Warren Brown, and we're here talking to Australia's most famous New Zealander, Sam Neill. Sam, tell us a bit about how you got into the world of acting. I mean, you're now recognised worldwide, and one of the things that always struck me is that you've never been typecast. How have you managed to do that?
Am I not typecast? I'm not even sure really how I got into acting. It wasn't really by design. There was no malice aforethought. I was actually a documentary director in a former life. I used to sort of act in the weekends or when I could get time off my work. And then one day I got asked to be in a feature film and I sort of stayed there. I'm touching wood here because, you know, an actor's freelance life is a very tenuous one and you can fall off the perch at any time.
Yes, yes. One of your big breaks was a film called Sleeping Dogs.
That was the first feature I was asked to do.
Yes, and you moved on from there, and there's a little-known film that Peter Jackson, who made Lord of the Rings, another one of the world's most famous New Zealanders, a film called Forgotten Silver.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that. It sounds fascinating. It was a sort of mockumentary-type film, is that right?
Yes. That's the only thing I've done with Peter. He's been nice enough to ask me to do one or two other things, but I've never been able to volunteer. But I was in Wellington doing another documentary, which I was directing, and I wanted to interview Peter, and he said he would as long as I'd be in his documentary, which wasn't a real documentary. It was a faux documentary. And now there's been a lot of these faux documentaries, so you never quite know what's real and what's not anymore. But this was about a fictional New Zealand filmmaker who Peter made up. And when they played it on television in New Zealand, no one said it was fiction. And people were outraged that they'd watched this thing with interest, directed by Peter and all sorts of people who otherwise they were inclined to believe were telling big fibs like me.
I think probably the first time that I remember seeing you on, apart from My Brilliant Career, for example, but on Australian television was a role in The Sullivans that you had.
Well, thank you for remembering that.
As Ben, if I remember correctly. Was it Ben? Was that the title of your character?
Well, he was a married chap who had an interest in Kitty Sullivan, who was a young and hapless little creature at that point.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson had been the love interest previous to me. They'd bring one in for 3 months and then they'd find a way of writing him out, and then you had to go back to Sydney. And my last scene, Dave Sullivan came and gave me a good smack on the nose.
Right. You were
never seen again.
You were a sort of cad and bounder in that.
I was a cad, but, you know, a nice enough cad.
I remember that character in that he did live in Sydney, didn't he? He came from Sydney, and I seem to remember there was an episode, one of those rare episodes, where they actually moved the Sullivans mob, like the camera crew, to Sydney, and there were sort of gratuitous shots of the harbour bridge and the rocks
and
all that.
We
sort
had
of
2 days on location, something like that. But Kitty ran away to be with me, and, you know, I was married, and so we had to run away. But Dave cut us off at the pass with a decent right hook.
Well, it's funny, we've had a few people from the Sullivans come and visit us here at the weekend, and one of whom was Andrew McFarlane, and he had some pretty favourable memories of the Sullivans. And Michael Caton is someone that we've spoken to before too, and what he liked about that was the attention to detail they had for a pretty early, it's a long time ago, it'd be 30 years since the Sullivans were on. But
well, when you came in as a guest artist, artist may be too strong a word for someone like me, but when you came into the Sullivans, these people had been at it for years, you know, and they kind of had these alter persona. They weren't characters. They were really, you know, Michael Caton's
Uncle Harry seemed
as real on the set as he seemed on the TV. He was quite an interesting phenomenon to witness. And I never felt really entirely part of the crew because they all sort of knew each other so well, and they lived in this kind of fictional street. It was really odd.
And you were a sort of blow-in bounder from Sydney who'd come down and sort of, you know, the evil
dodgy
person from Sydney.
Very
to come
dodgy.
I think the next time that I remembered seeing you, your career took off in a spectacular fashion, and, of course, My Brilliant Career. Where did they make that film?
We were at Camden, which then was a beautiful sort of, it was out in the bush.
Yeah.
Now it's covered in houses.
Right.
Camden Park, specifically. We were also in the Monaro Valley, which either was stunning.
That's down towards Canberra, was it?
It's beyond Canberra,
Captain's Flat, that way?
Yeah, getting down towards the Snowy Mountains.
Right.
And another fly-blown part of Australia that I can't quite remember, but it featured a sort of outback dunny and a kind of a muddy waterhole.
Uh-huh.
I'd never really been to Australia prior to that. I'd come over for a week to promote Sleeping Dogs, and I knew nothing of Australia. I'd been to Europe and I'd been all over the place. I'd never been to Australia. When I was really knocked out by Australia. I remained so to this day. What a beautiful, beautiful country it is. And speaking of which, what a place Dunlivin is.
Yes, indeed. Dunlivin is, it's a jewel. A jewel on the coast of Australia. I mean,
this is the kind of place we always wanted to go to on holidays when I was a kid. And we wanted a little batch like this, but we camped, you see. My father was an extremely incompetent camper, and we always camp in places that meant that we would inevitably get flooded out or blown out, and a little shelter like this would have been a wonderful thing.
So where did you go camping on holidays? Where did you spend your holidays as a kid in New Zealand?
Well, we used to go up to the mountains, actually to where I live now. I've built a house there. I built my own little crib, and that's where I live now when I'm not here or somewhere else. You know, I got very fond of Central Otago. As a result of those holidays, even though, you know, terrible things happen to us and we always just get away with our lives.
Right.
So I decided when if I ever had some money, I'd build a house and live up there. So that's where I live now. And sometime later, we discovered that we could grow good grapes there. And
yes.
This was a real kind of, what luck.
Yes. You know,
but who knew?
The New Zealand wine industry, how long has that been going for? Is it something that's a fairly recent phenomenon, or is it something that's
There's been a wine industry of sorts since, for 100 years probably, right. when people from Dalmatia came out to dig kauri gum, which was something you don't see anymore, but they used to make it into glue and other useful products.
Like a sap type of thing from kauri trees, I see.
Just dig it out of the ground from old, it was fossilised kauri gum. It was a huge industry there for a while, and for some reason people from Dalmatia liked digging. So they came out, and once the kauri gum had gone, they had to find other things to do, and they started planting grapes.
Right.
So that was the origins of the wine industry.
Yeah.
But they didn't really start growing anything you'd actually want to voluntarily drink until the 1970s. So in terms of good wine, it's much junior to the Australian wine industry.
Right. Sam, we might, if you wouldn't mind, I mean, would you mind coming out into the yard and we'll just have a bit of a look at what I'm attempting to grow here and see what you think? And if you can think of any improvements, you can come out. Hang on, we'll go out through the screen door. Yes. Just watch out, there's a Monsteria deliciosa that is right there. It's a fruit salad plant.
Is that a snake that's going...
Probably, hang on. We don't let it near Billy here. So he'll sort of scarper up the drainpipe onto the roof if he sees a snake. But it probably... So we do get snakes here. We do. Not real flash ones, but they're not really... They're okay.
And these are your vines?
These are the vines, yes. What do you think? Well, it's not a... It actually looks a bit like Family Plot.
The grapes are encouraging, but the thing about vines is you want them to grow up something. I mean, you might want to think about trestles so that you can actually train them up.
What about the dunny? Do you think that they could grow up over the dunny if I cut the choco vines back a bit? Well, we do make choco beer, a very nice choco beer. Have a look at the dunny.
Is that the dunny, that thing?
That's the dunny under there. Okay, I'll just push a bit. What do you think? Okay. I'll just open the door.
Oh. I'm sorry, not... No.
Oh, it's
not fitting at all well, but...
Maybe it could add to it a bit of the... Oh, holy smokes.
No,
Sam, is there anything you could... Oh,
have you got a brush and some, you know, disinfectant? Maybe I could help you out here.
Yeah, we need a bit of phenyl, I think. Phenyl and creosote, we need a bit of that. It's a rustic sort of dunny. Look, if there's something that you can suggest, I've been experimenting with choco for beer and a bit of privet, and for the smashed crab claret, we've been using a bit of prickly pear, which is quite nice. And prickly pear's not normally a red colour, but we, you know, do some other creosote's a handy thing to put in, give it a bit of full body, you know.
Yeah.
The beaut thing about the smashed crab claret is that if you knock the glass over, it won't go anywhere. It'll just sort of sit there and congeal onto the tablecloth.
Yeah.
And then look like a glacier. It's a New Zealand kind of thing.
Yeah. I'll come back to you on the wine thing. What is that thing?
Well, there are creatures in Dunlivin that Australia doesn't have at all either. I'm not quite sure what that is. I'd give it a whack. Yeah.
Let me just lift it. Oh, there's more of them under that seat, isn't there?
Yeah.
Hang on.
Out in Western New South Wales, and that some of the dunnies out there, so they have shingle-back lizards. I don't know if you've seen those. And up at Lake Cajiligo and Yagara, they call them bog eyes. And in the long drop dunnies, if you shine a torch down there, and there's little, you shine a torch, the little eyes, they sparkle back at you. It's like a beautiful,
Let's see if we can see anything.
Any bog eyes down there?
Oh, my goodness me.
There's a very big bog eyes. What the devil's that?
That's very, very big spiders in there.
There are, yes, indeed. But it's all right.
But they're friendly.
Well, the trick is if you need to drop your strides, just have them bunched around, you know. Don't sit. And just get ready to sprint. If there's a groan or something that comes out from the long drop,
I won't be using it for a while. We've got a little work to do.
Absolutely. But, you know, if you wouldn't mind, any time you come back, if you've got any good sort of, Brown's backyard kind of suggestions you could suggest for my backyard, I'd really appreciate it, Sam.
Brown's backyard?
No, Warren Brown's backyard.
Oh, yeah.
No, Brian. What's Brian Brown's backyard like? Speaking of
it's
which,
foul.
You made a very unusual film with him called Dirty Deeds.
I did. Yeah.
Which is a kind of, just have a sit down. Sit on the garden bench here. Just have another. Tell me what, do you want some more of this?
It's a little shaky.
It is a little bit. It is a bit.
Just sit down a little gingerly.
It's good. Yes. It's made out of Uncle Ellis's coffin lid that we had years ago. They had to move the cemetery, and we asked that. It's a nice feature. Let us have a bit of.
He's not here, though.
No, thank goodness, no. But they let us, as a bit of a souvenir, a nice bit of objet d'art in the backyard here. We could, you know, later take his coffin with that. Not bad, though. It's not a very straight thing to sit on. However, Dirty Deeds that you made was a sort of bit like an Australian attempt at a kind of Goodfellas type of thing in a sort of humorous way. Was it an unusual film?
I had dinner with Brian last night. He's become my principal employer now.
Oh, excellent.
I did one of his Twisted Tales last year.
They're a great series, aren't they? A wonderful thing.
And that was fun. So I was disturbed to hear that he's fully employed until about August.
Oh.
Which means I could be just kicking my heels here for a while, you know.
In Dunleavin.
Would you mind if I just stayed?
Make yourself at home and look, seriously, Jason Alexander stayed here for a week recently, left the place much cleaner than we'd ever seen. But you more than well, Sam,
did
any
he leave
time.
Any food in the fridge or anything?
Well, that was a bit of a problem. But Dot, I mean, how's this? She rented our house out over the internet and Jason Alexander picked it up. And she left him a whopping Lamington and some Vegemite. And he went on this diatribe about Vegemite, how he couldn't understand how anybody could eat it. So I don't know what he brought in. He imported stuff. Maybe some of your wine he might have brought in. Would have been a good thing.
Is he a drinker?
I don't know.
Or a connoisseur?
I think he's a connoisseur.
Oh, he may have bought my wine then, because
he's a lot sharper than George Costanza. He was a wonderful house guest, I'll tell you. He really was. I don't think he ventured out into the Dunny, though. You've got to be a brave man to do that.
Where did he go? Did he go down to the pub or something?
No, I don't know what he did, actually. He didn't actually let on. He stayed here, though. But it looked like he spent most of his time cleaning the joint up, because when we came back, wow, it looked pretty darn good.
Good man.
He is a good man.
Yeah.
Lovely man.
Well, I might be here till August, so...
Well, we'll have a brand new Dunny by the time August rolls around. That's a marvellous thing.
And then hopefully Brian will have a job for me.
Maybe. Maybe Brian could come down there. Maybe we could do some, you know, some Twisted
Tales. I've been on holiday with Brian. I don't want to do that again.
Yeah, is he an interesting person to go on holidays with, Brian?
Last time we were skiing, actually. Yeah. And you don't think of Brian as a skier, do you?
No.
No, you don't.
Maybe
not. Well, he's apparently handy surfing, so I don't go near the water as a result of it. But he's too kind of iconic Australian to be a skier.
Yes.
You associate him with the heat and flies and brown dust, things like that. So it was alarming to see him on the ski field. And indeed, he had his own particular style. And I was always first to the bottom of the mountain, which irked him because he's very competitive. So since then, he goes skiing whenever he possibly can because he wants to get better than me, but it's not going to happen.
You're right. He's that kind of bloke that you would imagine skiing down a mountain with a sort of jug of beer in either hand kind of thing.
He's sort of bow-legged.
Is he?
Like he's been riding for too long.
Well, that's handy in certain skis.
It doesn't look good on skis, that bow-legged thing.
Look, something I wanted to ask you. And last year, in 2006, I was fortunate enough to be asked to be the overnight host at Gallipoli and to also be the host at Lone Pine, the Australian War Cemetery there. Mm. And there's a wonderful documentary that's made by a Turkish fellow called Tolga Ernek, Gallipoli, or the translation, of course, is Gallipoli. And you are one of the narrators on that.
I was.
It's an amazing documentary. And I strongly recommend it to anyone if you really want to learn about Gallipoli. An incredible piece of work. And
I was very happy to be associated with that. And I went to Gallipoli myself in 2000.
Yes.
I had a holiday in Turkey. And I went down there and had a day. I hired this Turkish bloke to take me down there. And we spent a day together wandering around Gallipoli, which was an extremely emotional experience for me.
Yes.
And I think it probably is for most Anzacs.
Yeah, absolutely.
I could count myself as an Anzac here.
Absolutely.
I'm descended from Anzac soldiers. So when I was offered the opportunity of doing some of the voices for that, interestingly, he wanted me to do the New Zealand voices, which I was happy to do. And then while we were doing it, he said, I think I'd like you to do some of the Turkish voices too. So I said, really? So he said, yeah. I found it extremely moving to be reading those letters particularly. And we were recording over in North Sydney, and there were times I'd choke up so much I couldn't get to the end of the letter.
Yes.
I had to take a half-hour break at one point because it was just too distressing for me.
Yes.
So when you hear the film, some of my stuff is a little more choky than it should probably be.
Yes.
But that's just what happened to me then.
Yes. It's interesting, when I came back from Gallipoli, I watched the film again, and I couldn't finish watching it. Having been there, it's a very unusual place. It's, you know, you hear about all those places when you love Shrapnel Gully and Anzac Cove and Chanuk Bear, where the great New Zealand battle was, and the Neck and these places. And once you go there, there's just something about that place that really strikes a nerve. And having spoken to people and experienced that and watching that film, that incredible documentary, and hearing you and Jeremy Irons narrate that that film, it's it fired up something that me that I couldn't finish. I couldn't watch it in one hit again. It was such an emotional thing.
Well, there's all sorts of reasons to go to Gallipoli, and not the least of them being that extraordinary text from Ataturk, which is on the monument at Anzac Cove itself, about the Johnnies and the Kamals lie here together. Your sons are our sons now too. They lie in our soil. Weep not, you mothers. You know that
extraordinary
oratory. That,
The spirit of that message is just so unbelievably generous. It's
and I wonder, did you go? There's another monument which my friend took me to, and it's about halfway up to Lone Pine. It's a monument to an unknown Turkish soldier.
Yes.
Yeah, remarkable story. And some of those trenches were about as far apart from each other as you are from me now. That's to say about 6 feet apart.
Yes.
And this particular part of the battlefield, they'd gone over the top in an attack, and it had been another grisly disaster. And in the heat of the day, there was a wounded, I think, English soldier lying out in the middle there who was screaming. And the screaming went on and on and on, and everyone was keeping their heads down in the trenches. No one wanted to, you know, there was an unbearable sound. Then suddenly the observers saw a white handkerchief go up from the Turkish trenches, and this big Turkish soldier jumped out of the trench waving this white handkerchief, and he strode over to the wounded English soldier, picked him up and carried him over to the Allied trenches and laid him gently into the arms of the soldiers who were waiting, who were so stunned by this, who were so gobsmacked that no one thought to say thank you or to ask this man who he was or anything about him. He strode back to the Turkish lines, jumped into the trenches, and was never heard of again. And no one can find out at all. No one has any idea who that soldier was. There were legions of witnesses that saw it happen, but none of the Turkish soldiers know who he was. It's completely lost. And that was another place that I found myself with tears coursing down my face. You know, nothing you can do about that.
No. Sam, come with me. We'll head back into the house. But in the meantime, is there another song that you'd like to listen to?
Well, since we're on holiday, I like reading on holiday, and I like short stories. And here's a song that's a bit like a short story in itself. It's a bit like a Somerset Maugham story.
Yes.
It's a group called The Divine Comedy, and the song is called, it's like a little short story in itself. It's called A Woman of a Certain Age.
Fantastic.
Back in the day, you had been part of the smart set. You'd holidayed with kings, dined out with starlets. From London to New York, Capetta to Capri. In perfume by Chanel and clothes by Givenchy, you sipped Camparis with David and Peter at Noel's parties by Lake Geneva, scaling the dizzy heights of high society, armed only with a checkbook and a family tree. You chased the sun around the Côte d'Azur until the light of you became obscure and left you on your own and in an English lady of a certain age. And if a nice young man would buy you a drink, you'd say with Acorn's spiritorial wink, you wouldn't think that I was 17. And he'd say, no, you couldn't be. You had to marry someone very, very rich, so that you might be kept in the style to which you had all of your life been accustomed to. But that the socialists had taxed away from you, you gave him children, a girl and a boy, to keep your sanity. A nanny was employed, and when the time came they were sent away. Well, that was simply what you did in those days. You chased the sun around the Côte d'Azur until the light of youth became obscure and left you on your own and in. An English lady of a certain age. And if a nice young man would buy you a drink, you'd say with a conspiratorial wink, you wouldn't think that I was 63. And he'll say, no, you couldn't be. Your son's in stocks and bonds and lives back in Surrey. Flies down once in a while, leaves in a hurry. Your daughter never finished her finishing school. Married a strange young man of whom you don't approve. Your husband's hollow heart gave out one Christmas day. He left the villa to his mistress in Marseille. And so you come here to escape your little flat, hoping someone will fill your glass and let you chat about how you chased the sun around the Côte d'Azur until the light of youth became obscure and left you all alone and in the shade. An English lady of a certain age. And if a nice young man would buy you a drink, you'd say with a conspiratorial wink, you wouldn't think that I was 53. And you'd say, no, you couldn't be.
With Warren Brown at the Weekender, and we're here having a glass of very nice run-of-the-mill Chardonnay with Sam Neill. Sam, have a seat by the kitchen table here. Mm. You were asking me before while the song was on about the surf around here.
How was the surf? I was thinking getting up in the morning and, you know, taking the old board down and giving it a bit of a lash, but are you often seen on the beach?
Rarely. When we're looking for... Sometimes when, you know, Billy Hughes, our dog, he often runs out into the surf and he actually gets swept out. And when the tide changes, he gets swept back in. He's lucky because he's built like a sort of beer keg with little legs like toothpicks. and he floats.
So he looks a little like my duck. He's got a bit of Staffy in him, is he?
He's got a bit of everything in him. Yeah. I mean, you know, every conceivable bit of canine stuff is. That's why he looks a little bit like sort of Dr. Frankenstein's dog. Like he's been sewn together from. But that's just the way he is.
But is that because has he been attacked by sharks at any point? Because he looks a little.
No, he goes out. He does a bit like that, but he can hold his own out in the surf there. Sharks, they sort of leave him alone, you know. He's very tough. They're chewy, you know. And then he gets a beer keg floating, and they won't even bother.
Yeah.
And did you bring a board with you?
Because, I have. It's on the top of the ute.
Oh, because I was going to say that the garden seat out there in the yard, which was the lid for Uncle Ellis's coffin, you can use that if you like. It's pretty good.
That's why it's fiberglass.
Yeah, that's right. That's why it's one of the few fiberglass coffins that we have. You know, the surfboard shop in the main town doubles as a kind of, you know, coffin-making operation there.
Yeah, it's nicely pointed at the end.
Indeed. One of the great coffin makers of all time was Sean Connery. He had a job in his early years polishing coffins. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
And, but of course, he was the first James Bond. But there was a while there when you were touted as being a James Bond.
My agent was interested in that. I wasn't interested in that at all.
Yeah.
She was a very, I can say this safely now because she died.
Oh.
But she was a very commanding sort of presence, Maggie, and she imperiously sent me off down to Elstree Studios to audition for Bond, which I did. And I don't know why I said yes, because I never wanted, you know, it wasn't something I wanted to do. I would have been a crap Bond. And
why do you think you would have been a crap Bond?
Why? Well, you've got to sort of be James Bond too, you know. And I'm a sort of.
Do you think so? Do you have to?
Yeah, you have. You can't sort of ponce about in the eastern suburbs, you know.
Right.
I don't know what I mean by that, really. But you have to be sort of. You have to live the life, and I wouldn't be.
We have a casino here in Dunleavin. You could have played the chocolate wheel or something there. Yeah. We don't have Baccarat, but, you know, an Aston Martin, all that sort of thing, didn't appeal to you?
No, I'm not really in it. You know, years ago I bought a Porsche, and it lasted for 2 weeks because I felt just like a complete fraud and a poseur.
A poseur.
In this car. So I sold it and, you know, went back to driving minis. But my dog, who looks a little bit like yours, except slightly less shark-attacked, at the front of my Mini last week. I'm still a little bit upset by it, Warren.
Oh.
Well, I think what happened, you know, she's very conscientious when it comes to rabbit control, and there's a lot of rabbits around this year. And I think one of them ran up into the engine or something, and she takes these things extremely personally and decided to rip off the front of the car to get at the rabbit.
Ah, you know, see, I mean, rabbits under the bonnet are a whopping problem around here.
Yes, they would be.
I mean, there are times, you know, I wake up in the morning and go out to the Austin A40 and I lift the bonnet up and I think, it's just chock-a-block.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's noisy when the fan belt starts going.
Oh, boom, yeah, boom, they don't boom, like, no, boom, boom, boom. They
that's
hate
multiple
that.
Rabbits. Boom, 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 boom.
Very hard to get the thing going, you know.
I sympathise with you.
I've digressed from here, but so you weren't keen to be James Bond, but the interesting thing was, I think, was that it was Timothy Dalton who ended up being the James Bond around the time that you were...
I suspect he wasn't very happy in the job, but I don't know for sure. I don't really know him. I've run into him a few times.
Yeah.
But I'm very impressed with Daniel Craig. I think he's really... And the last film, which is directed by a friend of mine, Martin Campbell, who did a previous Bond, I think it was called GoldenEye. Which was the first Pierce Brosnan one.
Yeah.
He's the best Bond director, you know, by a long chalk. He's fantastic. And this new film, I think, is great, and I really like Daniel Craig.
Yeah, I've not seen Casino Royale, but...
I imagine it'll be coming to the coast here before too
It
long.
Will be, at the drive-in.
Oh, you have the
Dunleavin drive-in, yes. Yeah. But it's not a very big drive-in. Dot has a slide projector screen, which is only 6x4. So by the time you can really only have two cars go to the drive-in.
Because
she has it in a garage, you see. So the drive-in, you drive into the garage, and she's got the projector, the bell and howl up the back. And when that reel ends, you know, then she switches the lights on and she gives everybody a cup of tea. It's bad for continuity, you know.
Well, we've got one of these in my little hometown. We have the cinema, and these days films are only 2 reels long. They used to be 8 reels long when I was at school.
Right.
So they're always changing reels, you know. The lights would go on and people would throw things. Now they seem to be 2 big reels.
Right.
But we have a half time for movies, and we are able to go out to the foyer and have a civilised drink. It's good.
How lovely. Mm. Tell us a bit about Hunt Away Films.
Well, Hunt Away Films is more of a notion than a reality.
Right.
That's what most companies are, aren't they? You go along and you register a name, and then you do something notional with it. We are a small concern. There's only three of us. John Clark is the other coast dweller. I think, is his batch fairly close to here? After we've had a swim tomorrow, we might see if we can find him.
I'm as keen as mustard. We'll do that.
Anyway, he's one of the three of us, and we notionally, we look for things to do, and which will keep us gainfully employed into our old age. It's not easy finding things that you really want to do, and the older we get, the lazier we get. So our output is fairly minimal, but such as it is, it's top quality.
Well, R&R Films, which was Rupert Murdoch and Robert Stigwood, only ever made one film, and that was Gallipoli, and it's at a 100% success rate, that company, because they've only ever made one film. But mind you, it was a whoppingly big film. So there you are. There's
top producer.
Absolutely. And speaking of John Clark, one of my favourite films was Death in Brunswick, which I think was a lovely little film that you and Zoe Caritas and John Clark were in.
Mm.
And there's a wonderful scene in that where sort of lugging this dead body around. And
Speaking of coffins.
Mm. And it's just a lovely, it's just such a wonderful scene there.
Yes. It mostly comes from the book.
Yes.
Where he has to make room for the person that I've inadvertently murdered.
Yes.
By making Mrs. DeMarco, who's buried some years ago, a little bit smaller, a little bit more compact than she was before.
Yes.
I think the passing wind joke, that was something we devised on the night, but otherwise it's pretty much...
That's a very, very funny gag, that thing there. It was just kept lugging this dead body through the dead of night and it makes this noise. Was that you? No. It was like, oh.
That's right. Well, I had inside information that a corpse will occasionally pass wind or sit up. They do things that give people a fright, and one of them is the old wind thing.
Oh, there you are. Oh, it's Warren Brown here at The Weekender, and we are talking to Sam Neill, of course. And now, Sam, The Weekender, as everybody knows, is the home of the ukulele nowadays. Mm. Everybody who is anybody, or vice versa, anybody who's everybody, whatever, they are great ukulele buffs. So you're a bit of a ukulele player yourself, is this right?
I play the ukulele, not well. I only play it really when I've got someone playing a louder instrument, like a
bagpipes or something,
something that buries the sound of my ineptitude. But I do enjoy it. I was doing a film called Molokai with David Wenham, directed by Paul Cox, about 10 years ago in Hawaii, and all the crew blokes, these huge Hawaiian guys. When you're having a beer afterwards, and when we were in a leper colony, you know, on the island of Molokai.
Right.
And at lunchtime or afterwards when you're having a beer at night, there'd always be someone playing a ukulele. And it was like breathing for Hawaiians, you know. And to see these huge men playing these tiny wee instruments. So, so beautifully, I thought, well, look, if they can do it, I can. So I bought my first ukulele then.
Right.
And I've been very attached to the instrument ever since. The great thing about a ukulele, you can always put it in a suitcase or you can carry it onto an aeroplane. It doesn't matter how badly you play it, it always brings a smile to another person's face. George Harrison, of course, always took two ukuleles with him.
He'd take,
even on an aeroplane, he'd have one for himself, and if there was anyone else in first class or down the back of the plane or wherever he was could play the ukulele, he'd want to play with them. He loved the instrument more than he loved guitars.
Look, I'll leave you with it. What I will do is I'll give you the keys to the house and you can have the house during the week.
Yeah.
And look, if you want to come back at some stage and play the ukulele.
You know, are there any girls on the beach? Because
there's Dot. He lives up the road.
My
she's sort of a girl in a kind of, after a fashion. She was once upon a time.
There's an old bloke who was a Bondi boy who died last year, who I remember with great affection. His name was Jimmy Spence. He'd play the ukulele. He said it was an absolute babe magnet.
Really?
So, you know, every time I hear a ukulele, I always think of Bondi Beach and Jimmy Spencer.
Sam Neill, this has been a wonderful time spent with you. Thanks very much, mate. And look, why don't we listen to a classic ukulele track?
What we should play is that Hawaiian guy with the name that goes on forever doing Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
raindrops high above the chimney top. That's where you find me, oh, somewhere over the rainbow. Bluebirds fly and the dream that you did to, oh, why can't I, oh, someday wish upon a star, wake up with the clouds up far behind. Be where trouble melts like a lemon drops, high above the chimney top, that's where you find me.
Tell you a story.
John Travolta wants to meet you. What's with the wiggle?
Every day in January, ABC Audio will give away a different CD. There's something for everyone, from Enough Rope, Unstitched by Kerry O'Keefe, to Absurdistan by Eric Campbell.
I'd reached a stage where I no longer thought it strange to leave a wife and baby to go to a war.
Go to abcaudio.com.au and follow the summer links. ABC Audio Summer Listening CDs, available at ABC shops, ABC centres, retailers and online.
The Weekender with Warren Brown on ABC Local Radio.